You live in the States. You must have a car.
Do not have a car.
Do not have a car. You wouldn't have a DeLorean if it was given to you?
A DeLorean, I would. Yeah. I might be a little bit self-conscious of the way those doors open on the sides. It's a little flashy for me. But given the history and the power of a DeLorean to transcend time, fourth dimension, I would take it. And I would use it. So where would you go? To the future or to the past?
I would go to the past many times for tourism. I would enjoy seeing the differences between now and then. How about you?
Yeah, I was torn the more I thought about it. I think I've always wanted to, sounds like you, to travel. I would love to have traveled in a time when, and not that far back, I guess like maybe 100 years ago, something like that, maybe even a little bit less, 80 to 100.
Oh, you could meet H.G. Wells.
Time when, yeah, when there was just less tourism before there was such kind of globalized branding and McDonald's or Starbucks, you know, around the corner from major tourist sites around the world. So just to be able to go back and do some slow traveling by boat, by land, by train, to experience some other cultures. But if I had to choose and I could only go one direction, I think I would go to the future.
Ooh,
I just,
poor K.
Yeah, I just am very curious about where and what everything, where we end up, how things might be in anywhere from 50 years from now to, so anything beyond my expected lifetime, I guess. I would love to see that.
Okay.
I wonder if we make it.
Exactly. Okay. You travel just a little bit and everything's cool. Everything's okay. In the future, you're traveling in the future. You travel a little bit more and things are way different.
You might end up being like, you wind up being the source of some experiments trying to figure out what we used to be way back when, or I would just be so low on the sort of totem pole there of intelligence, or maybe I just end up as a piece of meat for a giant butterfly like creature or an enormous crab. Spoiler alert.
So assuming you see this and you detect, oh man, these beings are way smarter than I am, and I don't want to end up on the dinner table or dissected as an experiment, and you push on. Would you push on to see what's next? Or would you say, I'm out of here, I'm going back home?
It would be hard not to push on. I suppose it's a little bit of FOMO, or yeah, there's a tendency there, just kind of a little further. You can get into real trouble that way, as the time traveler nearly did. Spoiler.
Nearly did, yeah.
And yeah, I think it'd be hard not to want to go until that last ultimate moment. I think you'd be pretty lucky not to end up stuck somewhere or annihilated. I don't know what happens when you arrive to a point when maybe the Earth's not even there. Can you still get back? Can you stop it?
Yeah, stop in reverse.
Yeah, real quick.
Turn around. Run away.
Yeah. It seems to be a quick activating, quite the lever there in this machine. That
you gotta love the levers.
Yeah.
Levers of power. Okay. No, let's not stop there. Okay. You got us past the Earth. The Earth has got a shelf life, just like the sun. But what about the universe? Aren't you curious about the universe? Would you push on to see where that all goes?
Why not? I'm here with a man who would never run out of matches, nor forget to take his Kodak camera. A man who, like many scientific people, knows very well that time is only a kind of space. Who I very much enjoy talking to across time and space. Eric.
Oh, thanks, Chris. That was awesome. But I have to say, I totally run out of matches first day. I'd be lighting fires. I'd be trying to light up the dark for sure. And my camera, if I can remember to take the lens cap off, I think I'd be okay. But can you imagine getting right there and taking all the pictures, coming back, developing the film, and there's nothing there? That would happen to me.
That would be the worst. Yeah. And then showing it to your buddies and saying,
yes.
See? Yeah. Couldn't you have brought back flowers or something? Give me a break. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, which we're going to be talking about today, is just a lovely story. It is so well written. I just loved it.
I don't know that I loved it. I, if we're going straight to feelings about it, I enjoyed it. The second time I've read it, it's fun. It's a short read. It's really a novella. It's fun. I think, well, I should say I did. I don't know if I go so far as to say I love it, but it's a fun read. I think where it stops short of love is just, it's given what we know now and where we are in the world today, it reads so much like fantasy to me, beyond the machine itself, like this futuristic depiction. While I think it makes sense for what was known at the time, I enjoy being in a futuristic world that's a little more, even though it tends to be less lovely in some ways, an extrapolation of our current world right today in all its messiness.
Let me get this straight. You would want to go in the future 800,000 years and want to buy a latte in a coffee shop?
No, I just wonder what strange things people may be injecting themselves with other than lattes. If we extrapolate from, let's say, our use of devices and possible, you know, virtual reality or whatever, what do people even look like? He ends up in a world that is without any sort of, much in the way of any kind of technology, as far as we know. There's two kind of, how many years in the future is he? He's like
800,000 plus.
800,000 years in the future. Okay, yeah. That's a long time. And at that point, and who knows, right? Maybe it is, as he says, after the fall of humanity. And in that way, maybe it makes sense, right? But it's a place with the ruins of what was society. And there's this group of what were people, or still a sort of version of people, the Eloi, that are kind of hairless, 4 feet tall, silly creatures that eat fruit and frolic all day and laugh and play and procreate a lot. And then we've got this group of what was once people underground, the Morlocks, that are blind and almost larva-like, yet hairy and gray and, I guess, apish. Lemures, I think he refers to them as. And they're, spoiler alert, there will be spoilers in Life Death Sci-Fi, they're eating the Eloi. But he ends up in this place where they've just gone so far away from any sort of technology. In the version I read, 2005 Penguin Classic, it's got Wells's own foreword to the novel. And he said it was too crude, the way that he depicted those two groups as so distinct and in that way.
Oh, he had that in the foreword?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I felt like that myself. I doubt we're all having lattes somewhere in the future, but they're not milk-based lattes, but I don't know. I enjoyed it as a fantasy novel. Maybe we could talk about what this new sort of theme we're embarking on of time travel really had me thinking about questions of what is science fiction. And in some ways, this is definitely science fiction, I would argue. It has a...
Agreed.
That part read like fantasy to me.
Our theme for this season, Life, Death, Sci-Fi, is time travel. And before this, we were on Mars a lot. What we did there, and I don't know if we're going to do the same thing here or not, but what we did there was we took the Martian novels, the literature, from the earliest to present day. And I'm struck by our conversation because it seems very similar, because we were talking about how the first Martian stories were well stuck in fantasy and had a little bit of science with it. In the same kind of time, span too. Late 1800s is when the Martian books started coming out, and similar to this story. I find that interesting. I'm not sure what to do with it, but it's interesting.
This reads a little bit to me like A Princess of Mars or Aelita, The Decline of Mars, or maybe even Red Star, Engineer Lenny, Out of the Silent Planet, like all those stories, those early ones we read about Mars. It reminds me of those. I think that's part of why I was saying that. So I absolutely enjoyed it. I think what these novels used to be called were like science romances or something.
It was. I know. I saw that and I thought it was cute.
Yeah.
And that makes sense because I think that's how you sell those things. And then the evolution of the genre turned into something bigger.
And a bit of a segue here is that unlike, say, A Princess of Mars, where he ends up through a cave, right, ending up on Mars, one of the distinctions for Wells is that he was really the first one of, if not the first, to use something scientific, this machine, as a means of traveling in time.
And he used his little dinner party buddies. And I thought that was just a lovely way to do his explaining about this new invention. He started talking about the theory of relativity. He was talking about dimensions, and he was talking about gravity, and he had all these pieces there 10 years before Einstein laid out his theory. How is this? How does this happen? People are thinking that?
Yeah, in that same foreword that I read, he talked about how he was pretty sort of humble in a sense of just saying that these were ideas that were around at the time and people were discussing in cafes and things like that. And he started this as a student. He didn't really say I came up with this necessarily, but these were ideas that were being discussed. And his sort of invention was the time machine itself, but not the idea of a kind of fourth dimension.
Yes, but that led to the machine. If I didn't have that explanation in the beginning of the book, the time machine wouldn't have been as powerful. He set me up as a reader. He set it in my mind that, okay, how is this possible? Oh, it's possible with this machine over here that can do it. And then he did such a wonderful job of taking us through a day, through an afternoon, through a day, through a week, through months and years spinning by. Here's a problem I had. I read the book and thinking about the book, I thought, okay, there are a couple movies about this. So I got the earliest one, but they changed the book a lot. Like that scene that I was just mentioning about how the years spin by and things change. The movie, the first movie, there have been so many depictions of this story. The first movie did a good job with that, but they had him stop several times. And then they added a theme to the story. The theme is the destruction of war. Watch out for atomic bombs and World War I and how people died and all of, you know, humanity is just doing this to itself. And so I have to go farther to see if we get out of this. And that's not the story in the book I read. It's different. But it was close enough in several spots that reading the book, watching the movie, I have to be very careful about how I think about that, because it's one is the movie, which is very different than the book.
I probably came off too, critical at the beginning there with just whether I like it or not, because I did. I do feel like, say, if there's nuclear war or something that destroys humanity, and there we are hundreds of thousands of years later, and this is where we've ended up with these two sort of races. The idea that we might, hundreds of thousands of years from now, if we had destroyed everything, we might end up as these frolicking beings with very little, just living off the fruit of the land and existing without everything that we have today. maybe that's believable. It kind of recalls a bit of Margaret Atwood's Orcs and Crows. I can't remember the name of those creatures, but there's that other.
Yes.
Those other creatures that are not quite human-like, and they have these lower IQs, but they're, I can't think of the name of them.
Yeah, in order to create the human that is going to survive in his world that he destroyed, except for these creatures, he had to change some things. Yeah. Dystopian, you should have loved that part of the story.
I guess it's dystopian, right? Satirizing this idea of a utopia. Yeah.
Definitely was a time period when this was written where people were talking about utopias. All of those Martian books were talking about utopias. And political ideas are just very prominent in the stories, in the readings around the stories at this time. Surprising.
I read in the introduction, this classes, Warner wrote that the ideas in this grew out of two powerful tendencies of Victorian science. And one was the passion for machines. And the other was questions of like survival or individualism versus collectivism.
It makes total sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. When I first read this story, then saw the movie years later, and this is talking about in my past, I grew up in the time where we had the duck and cover for a nuclear strike. When the Morlocks come out of the underground, it totally made sense to me that nuclear war had happened. These guys stayed underground and evolved into that. And then something stayed alive on the top of the world and evolved. That's the basis of what I thought about this story. But that's totally not true because nukes weren't invented yet. So that isn't why the Morlocks were underground. I did a little bit of my research is that H.G. Wells, he spent a lot of time working in basements and there were tunnels around where he lived. So there were lots and lots of people under the ground. That probably was where he got that idea. Not from
I also read that nukes. So he grew up poor and so he could relate to that real working class. And then I guess an earlier version or drafts, this is also from the introduction, had the subterranean laborers rising against their upper world oppressors.
Okay.
And then he decided not to go that direction.
I honestly like the cannibalism that he put in there. I don't like cannibalism, but I thought, and the way that he gave you clues around the way. Here's one. As I stood there in the gathering dark, I thought that this simple explanation, I had mastered the problem of this world, mastered the whole secret of these delicious people. And he's not anywhere near the cannibalism part yet.
Delicious people. That's funny.
But he was, he's just explaining it. And then in the matter of, wait a minute, I could see no signs of crematoria or anything suggestive of tombs. But it occurred to me, possibly, there might be cemeteries or crematoria somewhere beyond the range of my explorings. That's another clue as we're reading along. He doesn't just give it to us. And persuading myself that the thing I had seen was human, but gradually the truth dawned on me that man had not remained one species, but had differentiated into two distinct animals. That my graceful children of the upper world were not the sole descendants of our generation, but that this bleached, obscene, nocturnal thing which had flashed before me was also heir to the ages. By the time he says, for the first time with a sudden shiver came the clear knowledge of what the meat I had seen might be. Yet it was too horrible. I looked at little Weena sleeping beside me, her face white and starlike.
When he comes back, all he wants is some meat.
Yes. Yes. That's interesting.
He says, yeah, when he first gets back, he says, where's my mutton?
Yeah, he give said, me some meat. I'm starving.
Yeah, what a treat it is to stick a fork into meat again. And the editor sitting around the room is like, story. And he's like, story be damned, said the time traveler. I want something to eat. I won't say a word till I get peptone into my arteries. Thanks. And the salt.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's what that says. Yeah. It could be read as some sort of
another clue
or the whole book as a way to be sympathetic toward other animals and not eat those. Is this pro vegan or vegetarian?
Yeah.
Novel in some ways. It is strange. There's no other animals.
No, maybe they went first, eaten first.
Yeah. Dark.
Hey, well, this is going to take us.
Speaking of dark, I'll try to transition with that, or at least not too dark, but let's say candle light dark. What a cool kind of scene in the beginning, right? Where you talked about how he gathers his friends around, the time traveler invites them over. They're around this table. I'm looking at this part, maybe read. It says, the thing the time traveler held in his hand was a glittering metallic framework, scarcely larger than a small clock, and very delicately made. There was ivory in it and some transparent crystalline substance. And now I must be explicit, for this that follows, unless his explanation is to be accepted, is an absolutely unaccountable thing. He took one of the small octagonal tables that were scattered about the room and set it in front of the fire with two legs on the hearth rug. On this table, he placed the mechanism. Then he drew up a chair and sat down. The only other object on the table was a small shaded lamp, with the bright light of which fell full upon the model. There were also perhaps a dozen candles about, two in brass candlesticks upon the mantle and several in sconces, so that the room was brilliantly illuminated. I sat in a low armchair nearest the fire, and I drew this forward so as to be almost between the time traveler and the fireplace. Philby sat behind him, looking over his shoulder. The medical man and the provincial mayor watched him in the profile from the right, the psychologist from the left. The very young man stood behind the psychologist. We were all on alert. It appears incredible to me that any kind of trick, however subtly conceived or however adroitly done, could have been played upon us under these conditions. So he's got this other little mini time machine that he brings out, and it's all set up in a way. And I hadn't really thought about this until I checked out a bunch of books and read through their introductions and forwards. And it was pretty interesting, but a number of them, they just talked about how Wells sets this up in the style of a seance, which is a popular thing of the time.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, I thought, what a cool idea. He's writing in the time of like Edgar Allan Poe and Henry James, and there's all this sort of supernatural vibes.
Just a minute. Yeah. Just a minute. You said it. Edgar Allan Poe. People think he was a time traveler.
Really?
It's out there.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes or something. Interesting.
But I like the seance because seances were popular during that time. Houdini was famous for that kind of stuff.
Well,
when
he
died.
Oh.
Yeah. When he died, he left a will, a message that said that in this room, in this place, at this time every year, I will try my very hardest to come back to this world. And so for a long time, I think people gathered there.
No, that's interesting. But, yeah, there's something romantic about that, right? Maybe that's part of the interest to go back to a time when there was a general feeling of more mystery or awe at things that we don't understand.
And possibly we could find ways to talk to people who have passed over. Maybe that's possible.
Maybe.
We don't know.
The Houdini thing's interesting. Yeah, I love the seance. And the other thing, he leaves those flowers. Right? It said in the footnotes of the edition I was reading that there were often these seances, they would report something like often flowers that were supposedly from another place, right? And so they would appear in the room as evidence that somebody had passed, that something from elsewhere had arrived in that moment.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wonder if old HG was a seance goer.
It also reminded me of It's a Wonderful Life, right? Zuzu's Petals. You've seen It's a Wonderful Life movie? Christmas movie?
Yeah, but Petals. He
Bailey's his name, right? The main character.
Yeah.
It's a time travel story in its own way, right? Where he...
Yeah, for sure. Tries,
spoiler alert, everybody, that's still out there. I don't know any spoiler alert for It's a Wonderful Life. But he attempts suicide and this angel rescues him and allows him a glimpse into what the world would be like without him, right? You know, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which predates Wells here anyway. And so he, when he comes back, he goes into this world without him. He doesn't have his daughter's little petals. She wanted to keep these petals safe. And so she didn't wear her jacket or something to keep those safe. And she ends up with a cold and he runs off from the house. He's all upset and he has Zuzu, his daughter's petals, in his pocket.
Okay.
And they're gone. But when he comes back in the future, he's like, he's in tears, but he's so happy that he's got these flowers in his pocket again because it shows that he's...
Oh, boy. It's been a while since I've seen that. I've seen it many times, but I never caught that. Yeah.
I've probably seen that too many times. Okay. Yeah, 20 times now.
Wow. 20 times.
That was annual watch, really. I don't think I saw it this year, but most years. Yeah.
Oh, it's a beautiful movie. Yeah.
Anything else about world building or kind of the setting anyway? We talk quite a bit about, I guess, the future setting in many ways. We didn't really talk about the Morlocks, that underground world. I must have been mixing this up with a movie or something because I've read this before.
So easy to do.
Oh, I haven't seen the movie in ages. I must have seen the newer one. I don't think I've seen the old one.
When I read it again, fresh, this time for Life Death Sci-Fi, I still was pulling out the movie from the story I was reading because as a reader, I'm thinking, oh, I know where I am now. I've read this before, but this isn't happening. He was supposed to stop several times before he met the Eloi and Morlocks, but it didn't happen. And I thought,
In the movie, does he, or movies, whichever one, does he spend more time with the Morlocks?
No.
Okay. Yeah, in my head, he was like trapped under there and like actually captured and had to escape somehow. I must have just made that up.
No, I didn't watch all of the remakes of The Time Machine. I think that may have happened in the most recent one.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
That there's more of a dialogue. There was no dialogue between the time traveler and the Morlocks. He was always just trying to get his time machine and get the heck out.
You went back and watched the older one recently?
Yes.
Yeah, it'd be fun to do a little separate pod or something based on those film versions and compare them or something.
I want to talk about this little science bit that he put in here. And I really love the way it was presented.
This is the time traveler talking to his guests?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
The first time. Philby became pensive. Clearly, the time traveler proceeded. Any real body must have extension in four directions. It must have length, breadth, thickness, and duration. But through a natural infirmity of the flesh, which I will explain to you in a moment, we incline to overlook this fact. There are really four dimensions, three which we call the three planes of space, and the fourth, time. There is, however, a tendency to draw an unreal distinction between the former three dimensions and the latter, because it happens that our consciousness moves intermittently in one direction along the ladder from the beginning to the end of our lives. He's giving us kind of some scientific explain here and making it so that it's not clear, it's not based in formulas, mathematical formulas, but it seems a little possible. And I like that. I like that explanation. I think for me, it puts this book firmly in the science fiction category.
It's an extrapolation of science of the time.
Those ideas are, like you said earlier, floating around, and he's pulling them together to say, okay, this could be a possible explanation for time travel. And it's better than a ton of time travel stories that have happened since. Oh, there's this special door in the cellar, or this special door in the back of the diner that takes you back to 1962. That's a Stephen King book, not right. Scientific.
Okay, so you're getting into, a little bit of what we talked about last time, which is as we're going through this theme, this subgenre of time travel, but it's a subgenre of science fiction. And so time travel as a subgenre itself could be beyond science fiction, right? So it could be in fantasy or something. We need to draw some lines here. And I guess it's our podcast and we can do what we want.
Boundaries, man, boundaries.
Yeah. Can we come to some sort of agreement on those? I think we did last time. I think we were talking about Octavia E. Butler's Kindred.
Yeah.
And I picked up a copy and we were eager to read it. And then it was like, hold on a second. She says it's not sci-fi. Other people still lump it in with sci-fi. And so are we defining it as sci-fi? I think last time we were saying, it sounds like you're saying right now, in order for it to be time travel within the genre of science fiction, it needs to have some sort of, say, device / science-based cause of the time travel.
And
is that what we're saying?
Okay. Yes, it could be an accident in the lab. Where did we get Velcro from? Those kinds of things in the science world. We don't have to believe it. It doesn't have to be based in fact as a story. For example, H.G. Wells didn't have the facts to support what I just read about the dimensions. He didn't have any formulas. But still, it's wanting to be science. It's in that realm. So does that make sense?
Let's take a second and talk about definitions of sci-fi. I'll talk about a few here as they kind of relate to our conversation. We're talking about like whether, so what is science fiction time travel? You start to talk about where something like a single thing has changed or something's happened, right? That has to be science related that starts them on this time travel kind of journey. Ray Bradbury says that science fiction is about the possible, which I think is what we're talking about. Science fiction is about the possible, whereas fantasy is about the impossible.
Oh, I like that.
So we could say, to go back to Octavia E. Butler's Kindred, and this isn't much of a spoiler, but she, I think it's on the back of the book, really, that she, this character, is having these episodes where she suddenly is transported. She almost like a seizure or something, or passes out, and then she's transported back in time into the body of one of her ancestors. Cool idea, right? Really cool premise.
Yeah, into, I love the idea.
Yeah, kind of slave era. I think it's one of the characters' lifetime, but we would say that's impossible. This delves into the supernatural or something like that, right?
Yeah.
There's no kind of scientific possibility for this to happen? Or could there?
There are time travel stories out there that come from the premise of someone in a coma. And just like time travel, nobody knows if it's possible or what would happen. Nobody really knows what happens while you're in a coma. I don't think people wake up and say, oh, I remember everything.
Makes me think of like a idea for a story where maybe sometime in the future, scientists will be able to travel in time through our genes, that they can read so deep into them that they can read into all the lived experiences and traumas of the past. And you could actually transport yourself back to that moment and maybe fixing it, and thus fixing all of the traumas everybody who follows you would experience. If we think that, it sounds like it, like some of the people still experience trauma today that goes back generations or something, right?
Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. I have been fascinated with time travel for a long time, just as much as I've been fascinated with past lives, tracing your past lives through your genetic code. Yeah, is that time travel? Could be. I think that's a really good idea for some kind of a story there.
Yeah, somebody should write that. Richard Matheson, the guy who wrote I Am Legend, I guess he wrote a bunch of Twilight Zone episodes as well. He says that science fiction is about changing one thing, which is interesting. Kim Stanley Robinson says that sci-fi is historical fiction. Yeah, which makes sense. And of course, we've read a couple of his books, but I think the idea that it has to be somewhat believable or realistic, right? Because when we read Mars, it felt like we'd experienced the colonization of Mars in some way, right? It reads like reality.
Yes, I really liked that story. It was epic.
Yeah.
Epic story.
There's a sort of academic definition of science fiction that essentially is about, and I like this turn of phrase, cognitive estrangement, that there's something that forces you to almost experience your what you think you understand as a, almost a stranger to what you, the normal world, right? If something happens, so you become almost a stranger to it. And that there's a term that you like, this novum was the thing that was different about that world compared with our own. So I guess the novum in the time machine would be this machine, right? That can transport you from one place to another.
Okay. I like all of that. And probably the reason why I read science fiction is for that estrangement that makes me think in different ways.
Yeah, that's the overall. They talk about this, and I think we have before. It's the what if type qualities. I downloaded a Cliff Notes thing on sci-fi just for kicks, and it was pretty interesting. The word I've used a few times today, I think because of it, was this word extrapolation, right? That in some way science fiction extrapolates, just takes some idea from today and just takes it as far as you can. Like that word extrapolation, like there's got to be some sort of extrapolation happening in order for it to be sci-fi, which is different than, say, fantasy, right? Fantasy is not really about extrapolation.
I think fantasy does whatever it wants to. If you can't have something over here, then you can make up the whole setting and scene and give any reason you want for it, which is some fantasy writers are so good at that. And I enjoy fantasy too, for sure.
Yeah, I do too. I don't read a lot of it, but I always enjoy it when I do. I don't know why. Yeah, I read that more when I was younger, but every once in a while I pick up something, I always enjoy it. Yeah. Did you come up with a list of favorite science fiction devices?
Okay. The time machine and the time machine model are devices for sure. But past that, what did you come up with?
I couldn't get to a top three. I tried to make a number two with like fire.
The crowbar.
The crowbar. Yeah, it's fire, kind of interesting symbol in the story, but not really sci-fi, obviously. It's a tool.
De-evolution, dystopian, like crazy. Yeah. Hmm. This is one story that I didn't really read for all of the devices, but if the one main device wasn't there, then what would be the title? So it has to be the time machine. And I love the time machine, though. Description of it was just right for me.
I've got a little passage here just on page three. There's some good writing here, I think. He said, I suppose a suicide who holds a pistol to his head feels much the same wonder at what will come next as I felt then. I took the starting lever in one hand and the stopping one in the other, pressed the first, and almost immediately the second. I seemed to reel. I felt a nightmare sensation of falling, and looking around, I saw the laboratory exactly as before. Had anything happened? For a moment, I suspected that my intellect had tricked me. Then I noted the clock. A moment before, as it seemed, it had stood a minute or so past 10. Now it was nearly 3:30. And he said, goes on to say, I'm afraid I cannot convey the peculiar sensations of time traveling. They are excessively unpleasant. There is a feeling exactly like that one has upon a switchback of a helpless headlong motion. I felt the same horrible anticipation, too, of an imminent smash. As I put on pace, night followed day like the flapping of a black wing. The dim suggestion of the laboratory seemed presently to fall away from me, and I saw the sun hopping swiftly across the sky, leaping at every minute, and every minute marking a day. I supposed the laboratory had been destroyed, and I had come into the open air. I had a dim impression of scaffolding, but I was already going too fast to be conscious of any moving things. The slowest snail that ever crawled dashed by too fast for me. The twinkling succession of darkness and light was excessively painful to the eye. Then, in the intermittent darkness, I saw the moon spinning swiftly through her quarters from new to full, and had a faint glimpse of the circling stars. Presently, as I went on, still gaining velocity, the palpitation of night and day merged into one continuous grayness. The sky took on a wonderful deepness of blue, a splendid luminous color like that of early twilight, the jerking sun becoming a streak of fire, a brilliant arch in space, the moon a fainter fluctuation band, and I could see nothing of the stars save now and then a brighter circle flickering in the blue. That was pretty cool.
Love it.
For someone who starts, yeah, I can't convey it. I thought that was pretty cool. Like, really great mental image there.
Oh my gosh.
Spinning around him.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite passages and one of the reasons why I love this story.
He's critical of himself. He says he didn't feel like it was very well written in that foreword from just a few years later. But I think especially for his first novel, right? I think it's quite great.
When I saw it was his first novel, I went, what? How can that be? Of course, he wrote lots and lots before the first novel. But yeah, that's amazing to be so prescient and such a super classic. Everybody knows this story. Everybody knows this book.
Yeah, it really has. It's timeless. Yeah.
It uses many of the same themes that time travel stories have today. What I'm trying to say is the time machine has been rewritten in so many different forms, in so many different stories. And one of the things that I find when I read time travel stories is that it's very tempting to go into the future, then go a little farther, a little farther, and a little farther to see. It's like skipping to the end of the story, isn't it? How is this going to play out? And then how is the universe going to play out? Skipping to the end of the story. I don't know. If I was a time traveler, would I want to do that? Would I want to go to the end of time? And what is at the end of time anyway?
That's why I'd want to go. Yeah.
Curiosity? Is it just curiosity? Yeah. At least H.G. Wells gave us the end of our time here on Earth. It wasn't pretty or wonderful. It was dark and ugly. Is that what's going to meet us at the end of time? Will we be able to beat that by jumping in our starships and moving to some other place? Yeah. At the time of his writing of this, that wasn't a possibility. But since then, it's a theme. We had to leave because our sun was starting to go. So that's the end of Earth. That kind of thing. Yeah. So, grandfather of science fiction. Get him together with Mary Shelley. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody.
Did they ever talk? Or were they in the same time? I don't know.
I don't know. I think, when did Mary Shelley?
Similar. Hey, God, Siri, when did Mary Shelley write Frankenstein?
Here's what I found.
1816, before.
Wow. Long before.
Yeah, so they wouldn't know each other.
Some called him a few nicknames I think I came across. One was, I guess his family called him Birdie, which is funny.
Yeah, Birdie, I love that.
He was they call him the first futurist and the godfather of cyberpunk.
Oh, really? I didn't see that. I love that. Yeah, he absolutely would be. I love cyberpunk stuff. I love it.
Yeah, we'll have to do a cyberpunk. I keep saying this keeps coming up, and I just haven't read much in the way of cyberpunk. Maybe that'll have to be a theme at some point.
Oh, totally.
That'd be fun.
Put that in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely.
Cyberpunk coming to you soon from Life, Death, Sci-Fi.
This is his kind of version of where we might be going. Where do you think we might end up in a few hundred thousand years?
Okay. Now, remember my choice at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
I was going backwards. I wasn't going frontwards. I think I hesitate because of our monkey analogy. I think I would be a monkey on the steps, and I'd land my time machine in this place where I couldn't speak the language. I couldn't understand the things that were happening around me, much like a time traveler who came to the future in the late 1800s, came to the 21st century. That would be a lot. You ask me as a time traveler.
Just you, not as a time traveler. I think you answered that, I guess, by your earlier answer. I just thought, when you visualize the future, could it be anything like Wells's future, or do you think it's more the Matrix? What's the comparison?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And thinking about my previous answer, I'm not afraid to be a monkey on the steps. I'm looking around at stuff I don't understand. Hopefully I can just jump back in my time machine and move on or move back. But I think we're talking about the far future, not the near future. And that kind of, for me, that kind of changes day by day. And by the news I watch, hypersonic missiles hitting Ukraine from Russia, Iran and Saudi Arabia making a pact, the MAGA crowd going crazy in Congress. Sometimes I think it would be more like the H.G. Wells version in the far, far future. We won't be there. We're going to destroy ourselves if something doesn't happen. From there, I can only hope that some of the themes of Star Trek will come and take us away from that possible solution to our humanity. According to the Star Trek legend, when we develop a hyperdrive or the warp drive, then other species from the universe will come and greet us and say, hey, I see that you've invented a hyperdrive and now you're going to be traveling in our space. Here are the rules. Here's what the universe expects of you, that kind of thing. And I would hope that those species would come and say, now, in order for you to use the warp drive, you have to have world peace. Is there such a thing for humans as world peace?
That reminds me of I started listening to a couple of podcasts. I don't know. Maybe this is good cocktail chatter.
Okay.
Let me ask you this.
It's the Life, Death, Sci-Fi Cocktail Party post-podcast.
When it's 800, where were we at? 800,000, 700?
Ooh, yeah. Cold, yeah. Though.
Yeah.
You've got to build a fire.
It seemed like they were fairly warm. When you're sitting in your time traveler patented chair in the late afternoon light, under the shadow of the White Sphinx, sipping your fruit cocktail.
Okay, there we are.
Hopefully chatting to somebody other than an Eloy. What will you be chatting about? And I thought of this because you were talking about if somebody offers technologies, I think I'd be chatting about this podcast I came across that I'm enjoying titled Gundog. I've only listened to a couple of episodes, but it's created by some of the same guys that did one of the Star Wars series, some of the same writers. And the premise is like what you talked about. It's like aliens have arrived and they have offered humanity technology kind of way beyond their wildest dreams that could solve all of our problems, basically. And these aliens don't seem to have any weapons of their own. And governments get together and decide we don't need to make any kind of deal with them because they wanted to use, I think, some of the Earth's resources or something because they're coming from a different planet. And they're offering all this, but they needed some of the things that Earth has to offer. Of course, they seem like they didn't have any weapons. So rather than make the deal, they just take the technology. And it turns out these aliens have immense power and totally enslave and begin to annihilate everyone on Earth. She explains that in the opening kind of monologue. And then we're at some sort of an internment camp of some kind. And the story's kind of starting off from there.
Yeah. What a mistake. And we've made mistakes. Yeah. One of the words that I loved that H.G. Wells used is frugivorous.
Okay.
Frugivorous. It means fruit eaters.
Eating fruit?
Yes, that's what you said.
Frugivorous cocktail?
Yeah, frugivorous cocktails. Yeah, there we are. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, yeah.
Frugitini?
Frugitini? Ooh, you have just invented something right here on the podcast. Yeah. Oh, I had something I wanted to add to this cocktail party. And now the frugivorousness has taken it away. I know you did great research on H.G. Wells and the time traveler. As I was doing the same thing, I got lost in the web of real time travelers. Have you heard of this? Seen this? There are pictures that show people who are achronistic. Achronistic? Is that okay. How you would say it?
Yeah.
There is a drawing on an Egyptian tomb of this woman looking at her cell phone, or what looks like a cell phone. There's a guy in a crowd who is dressed in kind of modern clothes and has a camera that, you know, shouldn't be in that time. And there's a picture of that. This evidence that you can see that just poke you and say, oh, that maybe time travel does exist. Maybe it is already happening.
Interesting. Yeah. You'll have to share that. I'll look into that. We'll put that in the show notes.
I don't know if I believe the photographic evidence. Photographs can be doctored. These photographs have been around for a long time. I remember seeing them years ago and thinking, that's an interesting idea. And even from those photographs, I think some stories have been developed, like movie on time travel tourism. What I was talking about at the beginning of the show, but this is time travel tourism for disasters. You could buy your time travel ticket to go see the Hindenburg explode, or you could go see some other horrible tragedy. And then the story is when people get mixed up and things happen that aren't supposed to happen. Bradbury's, the name of it?
What is the name of that?
It's not the butterfly effect, but it's similar.
Yeah. Do you remember the name of that? Yeah, they go back.
Hey, Siri, what's the name of Ray Bradbury's time travel story?
I found this on the web.
Sound of Thunder.
Sound of Thunder. Siri, boy, you got the science fiction device help there.
Yeah.
I've never connected that. Beck laughs at me, but I do look things up, obviously, but I don't know. I can't get myself to use Siri.
I only use Siri on the phone for those small questions that are immediate for me. I want to know it right now. Otherwise, I'll do my research in different ways. I lived in Michigan, right across the street from Michigan State University. And if I was going to do some research, I'd use their library. And when the internet was just starting up, of course, I wanted to use the internet to do research. I could ask one question for $25.
What?
And someone else would, $25, and someone would type it in for me, and then I'd get a list. I had to really know what my search question was going to be.
Wow, that's expensive.
Yeah. Think about how many search questions you use now a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it was expensive. But I really wanted to use it to see what it was going to happen. Like ChatGPT. No.
We'll have to do that. One of the other, I haven't checked this out yet, but some kind of science fiction fan site that was called, I wrote this down. So the other thing I started reading was something like time travel. It's like a history of time travel,
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's probably worth checking out as well. Oh, the one I was just thinking of was called File 770.
I haven't heard that one.
File 770. Yeah, Mike. Yep. Science fiction fan site.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. Okay.
All right. Hey, great chatting with you. And see you at the Spaceman's Ball.
Yeah. Yes, as always.
Somewhere in the future. Yeah.
Yep. It's nice to see that the Russians got off their space station, and after 6 months in space, I wonder how many times they went around the planet talking about spacemen.
I didn't realize that had happened, yeah.
Yeah, they were stuck up there for a while, so 6 months is a long time.
Yeah. It seems like we're playing with some fire here in the world these days, huh?
Yeah. If you time travel in the past, you can avoid all of these kinds of conflicts and land in a place that is very peaceful and nice.
Life, death, sci-fi.